Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Michael Toscano in Chicago. Tens of thousands of delegates, party officials, news media, and protesters are pouring in for the Democratic National Convention. Ed O'Keefe is already there.
Chicago this coming week will host a political convention for the 26th time, more than any other American city. And while there are concerns about gridlock and protests, Democrats in this state are eager to help Vice President Harris make history.
But Ed tells us the Democrats will have to share the national spotlight, however.
As for the Republicans, they are not taking a rest while Democrats meet here in Chicago. Former President Trump is in Pennsylvania on Monday and is expected to be on the trail every day next week.
President Biden is pushing hard for a ceasefire and hostage release deal over Gaza this weekend, with a high-level messenger now being sent to Israel.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is set to arrive in Israel on Sunday, where he will meet with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Blinken's visit comes as Washington expressed hope in a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas following a two-day summit in Qatar this week. But Hamas rejected the outline proposed by the U.S. on Friday, claiming Israel added new demands to the ceasefire. Yotam Confino for CBS News in Herzliya.
There is some fear the talks could be drowned out by the sound of weapons. 21 Palestinians were killed in two separate Israeli attacks in central and southern Gaza this morning. That's according to the Hamas-run health ministry. Hurricane Ernesto has been hovering over Bermuda for hours now with powerful winds and heavy rain. CBS's Dave Malkoff is there.
A wild night last night as it was coming in the overnight hours, making landfall just around 5 a.m. local time as a Category 1.
The Weather Channel's Kelly Cass tells us the U.S. won't get a direct hit, but Ernesto is making coastal waters dangerous.
The surf is up. We've got dangerous rip currents out there from southern New England all the way down to the east coast of Florida.
A sweeping new maternal health law is about to be made official in Massachusetts.
A bill cleared by both legislative chambers in Massachusetts would create a pathway for midwives and lactation consultants to get licenses. It would also encourage the creation of more freestanding birth centers and establish a grant program to address maternal mental health and substance use disorder. The legislation would also expand the statewide universal postpartum home visiting program and mandate that insurers provide coverage for postpartum depression and major depressive disorder screenings for perinatal individuals. Jennifer Kuiper, CBS News.
Purdue Foods is recalling more than 167,000 pounds of frozen chicken nuggets and tenders because of the possible presence of metal in them. They're saying if you have them in your freezer, toss them out or take them back to the store. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm Terry Bell. Kids in Wisconsin will soon head back to school. Experts have a few tips to get them back into a routine and make sure they're in good shape physically and mentally. Mike Moan reports.
After relaxing over summer break, voices in the world of healthcare say activities like family bike rides or walks can help your child build up their physical stamina. That way, they might not be as exhausted during the first week of school. Nicole Marty, a nurse practitioner with Oak Leaf Pediatrics in Eau Claire, says if your child is anxious about attending a new school, there are some things you can do, like making an informal visit to the building to ease those nerves.
Visiting the playground and playing on the playground, you know, in the weeks before school starts, just so that they can get used to that and it's not such an abrupt start for them. That can be really helpful.
She says practicing breathing exercises in the final days of vacation is another relaxation tool. Parents are urged to get each child's annual medical or sports physical, immunizations, eye exam, and mental health assessment on the books as soon as possible. UnitedHealthcare Chief Medical Officer Dr. Rhonda Randall says it's important to establish a regular routine, including dinner with the family as often as possible.
Putting age-appropriate limits on screen time and access to social media. Setting a good sleep schedule, all of those things around consistency help your child feel more confident and secure and stable, and also promote their health.
Randall also suggests parents foster independence in younger kids, encouraging them to dress themselves and learn to use the bathroom, blow their nose, wash their hands, and put on shoes without assistance. Kids also need to feel confident enough to ask an adult for help when needed. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, chance of a thunderstorm with a high near 77. For tonight, scattered storms, 65. For Sunday, slight chance of a shower, otherwise mostly sunny, 76. 73 and sunshine for Monday. Tuesday, sunshine and highs in the low 70s.
Currently, 69 degrees.
Maggie Dawn.
It's the Democratic National Convention, everybody, and I could not be more excited. It kicks off with President Joe Biden, and I'll be joined by County Executive David Crowley.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 2 till 4. You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. In this, the second hour of our weekend venued broadcast about all things law-related, government-related, court-related, indeed consistent with that commission, Amicus, provide assistance and counsel, direction, insight into things important to our world, continuing in this weekend broadcast to talk about all sorts of things happening in our lower courts, including in this hour, things happening in Montana State Court involving abortion, things happening in a federal district court in California having to do with the access of Jewish students to areas on the campus of UCLA, things coming out of Maryland having to do with a ban on semi-automatic rifles, coming out of the Eighth Circuit in Iowa, a book ban subject of an Eighth Circuit opinion just this past week, and also coming out of the Eighth Circuit, an opinion on the SAVE plan, which is the President Biden's plan to provide student loan relief. All of those things coming out of lower courts, state courts, federal courts, that may in fact one day percolate up to the United States Supreme Court as it continues its review and analysis of all kinds of things on its docket. And along the way, no broadcast of Amicus would be complete without some mention beyond the past decisions of the Supreme Court about things that it is perhaps going to be taking up in the future. We have talked before about the fact that in this coming term, the 2024-2025 term, the United States Supreme Court has already granted what's called a writ of certiorari, basically said, we review a lower court decision having to do with gender-affirming care for transgendered men and women. That case is already on their docket, going to be argued in the coming term. In connection with that, however, another transgender matter happened, another transgender-related case decided, or more accurately, sort of not decided by the Supreme Court just this past week, this one involving sex discrimination in schools involving transgender students. The Supreme Court just this past week, as a part of an emergency petition, declined, said, nope, we're not going to limit two lower court orders that had blocked, prevented the Biden administration's new rules barring sex discrimination in schools that get federal aid. The court's actions effectively prevent the federal government, the executive branch, from enforcing any portion of its new anti-discrimination rules for transgender students. While these legal challenges continue to be litigated, percolating up, they involve protections under Title IX for transgender students. They're being litigated in the lower courts. The justices, Neil Gorsuch, and the court's three so-called liberals, Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson, noted their disagreement with the decision not to review the lower court cases, to take them up, and would have allowed the unchallenged provisions of the rules that are part of this administration package that supports transgendered rights in schools, they would have allowed those to go into effect as scheduled,
just right about now. The legal dispute, as you may recall from our previous discussions about this issue, again, presenting to the Supreme Court questions about what should happen at the Supreme Court level with respect to these lower court decisions. Legal dispute involves the Department of Education rule. It changes things that are aimed at bolstering protections for students and employees under the federal law that bans sex discrimination in any school or other education program that receives federal funding. And while the rule changes include many uncontroversial provisions, two federal judges, one in Louisiana, the other in Kentucky, had issued broad decisions that blocked the entire set, all of them, from going into effect in 10 different states, largely because of three provisions that are aimed at protecting transgender students. That in turn prompted the Solicitor General. Her name, of course, is Elizabeth Preligar. We've talked a lot about her in the past. She asked the Supreme Court to unblock those rules that are not being challenged, carve those out, and let those go ahead while the transgender provisions are litigated in the lower courts. And she said the lower court's blunderbuss approach is both wrong and consequential, this sort of bifurcation, trifurcation, messy way of handling all this. She said that many unchallenged provisions of the new Title IX rules should be implemented immediately. The effect of what the Supreme Court has done is that none of these goes ahead. And as a result, all of this, again, the subject of further litigation at the lower court level, transgender issues in our schools under Title IX, that also paralleling and also a part of the docket in the coming term having to do with transgender care, transgender issues, much on the docket of the Supreme Court even in the latter portion of this term, the 2023-2024 term, almost certainly percolating up again in the coming term that begins on October 1 of this year. Many interesting issues coming out of this. Title IX, Title VII, all kinds of federal statutes providing protections based upon sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, transgender status. The Supreme Court wrestling with those. We know that the Supreme Court a couple of years ago in this major decision involving Dobbs decided for the first time in almost 50 years, 49 years in particular, that the United States Constitution does not have vested inside it, under sort of a penumbra theory of civil rights, of human rights, a privacy right to abortion. And so in June of 2022, as you all well know, under the pen of Justice Sam Alito, the Supreme Court issued this major decision in Dobbs, finding that 50 years of tradition, understanding of jurisprudence, precedent in our nation was wrong. Judge Alito saying that the decision back in 1973 by Harry Blackmun, authored on behalf of the majority of the court members at that time, was simply wrong, and now correcting that, according to Sam Alito, hoping that this abortion issue would no longer be a part of the federal system. We know from the past term that was not the case. Two decisions coming out of the Supreme Court, really not deciding abortion issues, but once again indicating that abortion remains an issue for federal litigation. And indeed, it continues to be an issue, as everyone predicted, in the state courts, state referendums, state legislatures around the country. Now that we have this increasing patchwork set of decisions in states around our nation about whether abortion is illegal or not, the Supreme Court, the federal Supreme Court, finding that there is no protection under the Constitution, and now various Supreme Courts also taking that up, notably among them Montana just this past week. It overturns a 2013 consent law. How does this come about? What do we know about this particular case? We know that in 2013, the Montana legislature passed a thing called House Bill 391. It prohibited anyone under 18, anyone lower than the age of 18, from getting an abortion without notarized written consent from their parent or their legal guardian. Exceptions would be allowed in a medical emergency or if the particular minor successfully petitioned a court to waive that requirement. So all of that passed in 2013, 11 years ago. The bill would have become law without the signature of then Governor Steve Bullock, but it never went that far, never went into effect because the legitimacy of it at that time, long before Dobbs, while Roe versus Wade was still the law of the land, all of this was challenged by various groups, including Planned Parenthood there in Montana. And over the course of the last more than decade or so, the case has been bandied about. Litigation going on about the legitimacy of this House Bill 391 requiring written consent, notarized consent, from a parent or legal guardian before someone under the age of 18 could lawfully, legally get an abortion in the state of Montana. Went through several district court judges, as you can well imagine, during a 10-year period. Ends up with Judge Chris Abbott of Helena. And last year, Judge Abbott, finally looking at all of this, taking again the arguments of both sides into account, memorandums written, oral arguments made to him, he ruled that this law requiring this consent from a parent or legal guardian was in fact invalid. Why? Because it infringed on the right to privacy. Privacy, which is exactly what the United States Supreme Court had dismissed in its case in Dobbs a couple of years ago. What happens after that, of course, is the Attorney General there in Montana appeals that decision, saying the judge had used the inappropriate standard in doing all of this, and the subsequent litigation ensues. All of this going on in Montana. What happens just this past week, finally, the Montana Supreme Court taking up the lower court rulings, this legal challenge that stretches out for more than a decade, the Montana Supreme Court affirming the lower court, invalidating this state law that would have required parental consent before a minor could get an abortion in Montana. Here's what Justice Lori McKinnon writes on behalf of the court. She says this: "We acknowledge that the state, meaning the state legislature, the state as a government generally, has a substantial interest in preserving the family, protecting minors, and protecting the rights of parents to raise their children. However," she goes on to say, "when weighed against the right of a minor to make the most intimate and personal decision of whether to carry a child to term, the interests expressed by the state, by the government, by Montana itself, must be furthered by and substantially related to the legislation itself." There's got to be some connection between those two things, is what she's saying. "And the legislation must be narrowly tailored to meet only those legitimate legislative goals." The court, again, in the wake of arguments in March, finds that that was not done here. And that is the major ruling coming out of the Montana Supreme Court just this past week. Judge McGinnon goes on to say that applying the consent requirement to minors wanting to get an abortion but not those wanting to continue a pregnancy discriminates against those choosing abortion. Kind of an equal protection argument there. The opinion that was authored by Judge McGinnon was joined by Justices Jim Shea, Ingrid Gustafson, Dirk Sandifer, and Beth Baker, as well as District Judge Elizabeth Best, heard the case in place of Chief Judge Justice Mike McGrath after he recused himself. And yes, indeed, there are judges and justices around this country who recuse themselves when what? When there is a perception of impropriety, a perception of bias, a recognition that they should not be deciding a particular case. Here you've got the Chief Justice taking himself out of that because of his own self-determination that he should not be deciding that case. That is a good thing. Not so much on the merits of the case, but based upon our view about the integrity of the final decision. Justice Jim Rice, who is, again, among the majority, writes a concurring opinion. He also agrees with the result of the majority, but he also goes on to say that the consent requirement infringed on the right to privacy and should be found unconstitutional on that basis, too. As we continue to look at this case coming out of Montana, more on what the Montana Supreme Court did in their privacy rights and abortion rights for minors in the state of Montana.
You're listening to the Shaw WAUK, Waukesha's home for Up North News Radio.
It's 2024 and Worthington, Minnesota continues to shine. We've expanded so many things. It's a time of growth. We've expanded recreation activities with our indoor ice arena, our indoor turf rec center and playground, and our outdoor water park, Waterworld, is ready for another season. Our schools have expanded, and so has our industry. We're continuing to expand our population also, with lots ready to build on Glenwood Heights. So let's grow together in Worthington, Minnesota. It's worth a look.
Let's get back to live music in the lair with Kaylin Cole. The next song you have for us tonight is called 1103. Yes. Is that a time or a flight number?
Oh, that's actually really good. That's a good idea. I think I might have to write another song like that. You'll get 50%.
It's live in the lair. Grab the podcast now at maxincradio.com and listen live on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Shaw, WAUK.
This is Amicus LawReview. My name is Jim Santel. I'm your host, along with my terrific producer, Max. We're taking your phone calls, as always, 844-967-2789. Or you can drop us a note in the Civic Media app. Let us know what you're thinking. Ask your question in that forum, too. Talking all about this major decision coming out of the Montana Supreme Court. It's a state court, not a federal court, but playing in the wake of the federal Supreme Court decision in Dobbs in June of 2022. The Montana Supreme Court just this past week finding that a state law enacted way back in 2013, 11 years ago, that invalidated would have required parental consent when a minor under the age of 18 is seeking an abortion, invalidating that particular law, finding it is unconstitutional. We've got the majority opinion. We've got the Chief Justice recusing himself. And we've got a concurring opinion. Again, Justice Jim Rice concurring, agreeing with the result and saying, yes, indeed, there is an infringement of the right to privacy here, and it should be found unconstitutional on that basis. But he disagrees with the majority. That is the opinion by Judge McKinnon, finding that there was an equal protection problem based on whether a minor chooses to get an abortion or continue their pregnancy. That's how she described it. That's how the others on the court described it as well. Justice Rice says that there was a different treatment of those seeking abortion based on whether or not they were under 18. And the law wasn't narrowly classified and crafted to satisfy the state's interests in that case on that basis. So he comes to the same result, but a slightly different analysis. He also significantly criticized, and this is the reason for underscoring his concurrence, also criticizes what he calls the judiciary's failure to address this case in a timely fashion. Yes, indeed, Justice Rice, 11 years of litigation while this issue remains unclear in Montana. He says this, while perhaps no single individual or court bears all the blame, the public's confidence in the judiciary rests on the expectation the courts will faithfully execute judicial duties. He goes on to say, the public deserves better than what occurred in this case, and courts must do better. And so in addition to agreeing with the ultimate result by the Montana Supreme Court, invalidating this permission, this requirement for parental consent for people under the age of 18 to get an abortion, he also says, you know what, we've got to do better. 11 years is too far, often described as justice delayed, justice denied. He's basically saying the same thing. And admonishing his own branch, the courts there in Montana, for taking so long to get this decision in place. Appeals promised beyond this, arguably to the United States Supreme Court. That could happen. We know that you can take an appeal from the highest court in a state to the Supreme Court. That's in our Constitution. We'll see what happens. We'll continue to monitor that. Plainly, the issue of abortion not going away and arguably coming back once again to the United States Supreme Court, and Justice Alito and others who apparently in their previous opinions would like nothing more than to dismiss this issue from their docket. It continues to be on the subject matter, on the dais of the courts around the country, including state courts and federal courts as well. Lots of things going on once again in that all-important issue. Also in legislatures around the country, referendums, lots of things, even as we look forward to the next election here in November. Lots of jurisdictions wrestling with this idea in the wake of Dobbs about what our state says when it comes to the rights to an abortion in our particular state. Other cases that may also one day percolate up in both the district courts and also the appellate courts of some interest just this past week. Once again, let's talk about some of those. This is a troubling case. And it is also one of those that prompts us all to think not only about the nature of First Amendment privileges to protest and to assemble and to contest things in the public domain, but also the limits of that. And the importance, as the courts have said, the Supreme Court has said, the lower courts have said, of balancing the First Amendment rights, which are significant and legitimate, to advocacy, to speech, to press, all those kinds of things established by our founding fathers in that First Amendment, in the first Congress of our nation, but also ensuring that others likewise have rights, and that those rights to passage, to movement, to travel are not infringed. How does this case implicate those particular issues? Well, it has to do with a decision just this past week by a federal district court in California. It's addressing what happened on the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA. And the district court, in particular, the top headline, the ruling in the end, is the district court orders UCLA, the leadership there, to stop allowing and assisting in self-described pro-Palestinian activists' creation of what amounts to zones where Jewish students cannot move through campuses, holding that the university may not offer classes if Jewish students are prohibited from participating in those classes in that programming. If you are stopping Jewish students from participating in classes and other trappings of life on campus by virtue of you're not doing anything on your campus, that is in violation of the law. Federal District Court judge just this past week not only admonishing, but enjoining the University of California from not doing anything. How does this case come about? The occupants of these encampments on the university's property had disallowed Jews from passing through the quad on that campus unless they would disavow Israel and, by extension, their Jewish faith. Now, again, as a part of our commitment to the First Amendment, people can disagree about things, all this plainly related to Gaza and the war there. We can have disagreements about that, legitimate disagreements. But this notion about prohibiting a particular group of students, in this case, Jews, from passing through an open and public area on the university property, that is exactly what the federal district court said cannot happen. And the requirement that they would allow passage if they disavow Israel and, by extension, their Jewish faith, UCLA's position, stunningly, the administration position in this case articulated in the litigation before the judge, was that the encampments preventing Jewish students from accessing certain areas of the campus were not its responsibility. That's what they said in court. That's what they said to the judge in withdrawing, if you will, any responsibility of theirs from the responsibility to ensure that all students of all religious faiths, of all persuasions, of all interests, have access to the campus there at UCLA. Despite that contention, the university erected metal barriers around the encampments and directed that Jewish students leave, according to the allegations in this lawsuit. And here's what happens. Judge Mark Scarsi, S-C-A-R-S-I, he is a federal district court judge there in California. He takes a look at all this, and he comes to what is certainly the right decision. He says this: in the year 2024, in the United States of America, in the state of California, Jewish students were excluded from portions of the UCLA campus because they refused to denounce their faith. This fact is so unimaginable, he says, and so abhorrent to our constitutional guarantee of freedom that it bears repeating. He goes on to say this once again: Jewish students were excluded from portions of the UCLA campus because they refused to denounce their faith. He goes on in this description of his result here to explain that UCLA does not dispute that, does not dispute the basic core facts that are abhorrent, that are stunning to all of us. He said, UCLA claims that it is no responsibility to protect the religious freedoms of its Jewish students because the exclusion was engineered by third-party protesters. Mark Scarsi rejects that. I'm going to hear more from him on this broadcast of Civic Media here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for the Tom Allball Show.
CBS News Brief. Chicago is girding for the Democratic National Convention getting underway next week, and Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson says there will be demonstrators.
We're going to protect those individuals whose voices are being heard to make sure that they're safe, but we're also going to make sure that we have a vibrant, energetic, exciting convention that's going to launch again a history maker into the White House.
Mediators have high hopes for a ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war despite continued Israeli airstrikes in Gaza. CBS's Remy Innocencio.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken's return here could be seen as a positive sign that negotiators are getting close to that ceasefire deal. He is here to finalize what's called a bridging proposal, basically suggestions to find common ground in the gaps that still exist between what Israel wants and what Hamas wants.
Hurricane Ernesto hits Bermuda.
I know Bermudians are Hurricane Hardy, but this is a big storm.
CBS's Dave Malkoff, CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keyes.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
The Brewers beat the Guardians. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers beat the team with the best record in baseball, the Cleveland Guardians, last night, 5-3. Milwaukee's Aaron Civale held his former team that traded him last year to Tampa to no runs through six innings. Manager Pat Murphy.
I think he's just been really, really solid. And he's, I told you guys, I love this kid, man. He's prepared as all get out, and he holds himself accountable. When I had a rough start or two rough starts, he took on the accountability, you know.
NFL, Packers and the Broncos had their joint practice session in Colorado. Quarterback Jordan Love said the offense was challenged by the Broncos' defense.
There was a couple plays here and there that we missed. It just wasn't our best day productivity-wise, but, you know, it goes back to, you know, just being able to learn and grow from that. You know, seeing this new defense that we haven't really gone against, haven't got a scout, but we'll be able to go back, watch film, and, you know, learn from these opportunities.
The Packers and Broncos preseason game in Denver, 7 o'clock tomorrow night with Sports on Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, chance of a thunderstorm with a high near 77. For tonight, scattered storms, 65. For Sunday, slight chance of a shower, otherwise mostly sunny, 76. 73 and sunshine for Monday. Tuesday, sunshine and highs in the low 70s.
Currently, 69 degrees.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on The Shaw. 101.1 FM and 540 AM WAUK. And on the Civic Media app.
As a federally licensed broadcast company, this Civic Media station is required by FCC regulations to accept advertising by all qualified candidates for federal office. We also accept ads from state and local candidates. We do screen announcements from issue groups and PACs and exercise discretion in airing announcements with blatantly false claims or outrageous unfounded statements. These announcements do not necessarily reflect the views of Civic Media, its hosts, or advertisers, and the source of all issue announcements can be found online at our FCC public file.
Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute. Today I've got some wonky terminology, so bear with me. I'm talking about credit utilization and how that affects your credit score. Credit utilization just means how much of your credit you're using. So let's say you have a $10,000 limit on your credit card. Now, lots of us think it's okay to spend up to that $10,000 every month as long as you pay it off in full at the end of the month. Well, it turns out the credit bureaus, these agencies that assign us our credit scores, they only want us to use maybe 10, 20, or maximum 30% of our credit limit each month, like $1,000 to $3,000 tops if you've got $10,000 in credit. And your credit utilization counts for 30% of your total credit score. I don't love the rules, but knowing them helps us manage our credit scores the way we want to. For more about credit scores or just about getting good at money, check out my videos at Work Money Media on YouTube.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, he's known on TikTok as Mr. Global. Matt Randolph, an oil and gas expert, joins us to talk about the myths of prices. Don't miss it.
Matinair on Air, weekday mornings at 10.
My name is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Delighted, honored to have you with me and my producer, Max, as we talk about what's going on in the courts of America, including this federal district court in California, wrestling, although not with great difficulty, on this decision with respect to the passage of Jewish students on the campus of the University of California, Los Angeles, in and around encampments there during the course of recent protests over the war in Gaza. And again, this is not simply a matter of deciding property rights. It is an invocation. The reason why it's so significant, it is an invocation, illustration of rights that are conditional, right? The right to assemble, the right to protest, the right to advocate for changes in government, that is a part of our First Amendment tradition. But it's not unconditional. And when it comes up against the rights, the free exercise clause rights also in the First Amendment of other people, that's when judges like Judge Mark Scarsi step in and say, you cannot infringe upon the free exercise clause rights. And once again, he finds that the facts of this case, so unimaginable and so abhorrent to our constitutional guarantee of freedom, bears repeating, as he says, Jewish students were excluded from portions of the UCLA campus because they refused to denounce their faith. Went on to say, of course, that UCLA doesn't dispute that. Yes, indeed, UCLA acknowledges that that's exactly what happens, but says that UCLA has no responsibility to protect the religious freedoms of its Jewish students because the exclusion was engineered by third-party protesters. Well, Judge Mark Scarsi rejects that unconditionally. He says, but under constitutional principles, UCLA may not allow services to some students when UCLA knows that other students are excluded on religious grounds, regardless of who engineered the exclusion. And he gets it just right. He says UCLA made available certain of its programs, activities, and campus areas where certain students, including the plaintiffs, who again were petitioning against these exclusions, were excluded because of their genuinely held religious beliefs. The judge added that the plaintiffs have put forward a colorable claim that UCLA's acts violated their free exercise clause rights, noting that the encampment on what's called Royce Quad there on the campus of UCLA, beginning on April 25th, blocked access to several major campus buildings, including classrooms and a library. One of the plaintiffs quoted in this litigation told the court that he was unable to access the library because he understood that traversing the encampment, which blocked the entrance to the library, carried a risk of violence. Another said that she decided not to traverse Royce Quad because of her knowledge that she would have to disavow her religious beliefs to do so. Interestingly, UCLA had argued that the groups challenging this last standing because they could not demonstrate a likelihood that this would happen again. And Scarsi dismisses that. He says, it's well settled that evidence of past instances of enforcement is important in standing inquiry. Also noted that despite the university's creation of a campus safety office, the fact that students violated UCLA's protest rules three more times since the school changed policies is evidence enough that it may in fact happen again. The president of an organization that filed this suit said in a statement that the ruling, it represents, interesting, the first injunction, the first time against an American university over an encampment of this sort, is a step toward ensuring that Jews, like all Americans, have their constitutional rights protected, and went on to affirm, again, these fundamental rights under our First Amendment. Rights to protest, yes. Rights to assemble, rights to advocate, right to be heard, absolutely not unconditional. And when it butts up against the rights of people to move, to process, to engage in academics on a university, and implicates religious rights, also under the First Amendment, then it must fall. And that's exactly what Judge Scarsi has said in his major opinion of just this past week. A very interesting and important case coming out of the district court there in the federal courts in California. Other things going on, of course, in the appellate courts around our nation. As promised, we're going to talk in particular about two circuit courts. We're going to talk about the Fourth Circuit, which is Maryland and Virginia, West Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina. Those are the states that collectively make up the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. But we're going to begin with the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Eighth Circuit, a large geography in our nation, just to the west of us here in the Seventh Circuit. Seventh Circuit, here we are, Wisconsin and Indiana and Illinois. That makes up the Seventh Circuit. The Eighth Circuit, listen to all these states: Arkansas, Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, North Carolina, South Carolina, North Dakota and South Dakota. All of those states in the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, they come together. And again, district court decisions from any of the trial courts in any of those states, once again, South Dakota, North Dakota, Nebraska, Missouri, Minnesota, Iowa, Arkansas, any of those go up to the Court of Appeals in the Eighth Circuit. So what did the Court of Appeals do just this past week? Also, in the area of rule of law, things we have talked about before, the Eighth Circuit just this past week once again reaffirmed the blockage, the injunction against President Biden's new student debt relief plan. And it tees up, once again, a likely challenge before the United States Supreme Court. Once again, going to have to determine what the law is when it comes to student debt relief. The Eighth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals extends this brief pause that it put in place earlier this year. Its updated decision prevents the administration, the Biden administration, from moving ahead with what's called the Saving on a Valuable Education. The SAVE plan is what it's sort of publicly known as, until the court resolves the lawsuit, which could take months. But again, the Eighth Circuit just this past week, in a 3-0 ruling, calling the plan, the administration plan, a vast assertion of newfound power. And so the Biden administration fell far short of showing clear authorization from Congress, sort of invoking this major questions doctrine that the Supreme Court has recently articulated when it comes to determining whether executive action is legitimate or not. The new SAFE plan, the court went on to say, is an order of magnitude broader than anything that has come before. And the panel, again, rejected the administration's attempted workaround after a lower court judge, in response to some of the identified issues here, after a lower court judge invalidated portions of the plan at a previous stage in the case. Again, there's a lot of litigation going on here. Trial court. The appellate court, now the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, saying that the plan cannot stand. The new SAVE plan, in an order of magnitude, it says, it broader than anything that Congress, anything that can be permitted under this plan. What did the plan specifically say as it was set forth by the administration? The plan contemplated two phases. The first one occurred last fall, and it raised the income-protected from payments from 150% above the federal poverty guidelines to 225%, and also waive some accrued unpaid interest outside those calculated payments. So that's a lot of math. That's a lot of procedural goings on there. Basically, it raises the income levels that would be provided under the plan. That's the first portion of it. The second portion of this plan, again, invalidated now by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, was set to occur again in the near future, when undergraduate student loan payments were to be dropped from 10% of discretionary income to 5%, and other loan forgiveness options became available to certain kinds of groups. Again, redescribing the plan based upon what the Supreme Court had previously identified as problematic. The new ruling, again, invalidating this revised plan coming out of the district court, now the appellate court, adds new confusion, a description that we get a lot now when it comes to these kinds of decisions coming out of appellate courts, the Supreme Court, especially with respect to borrowers who have been sort of in limbo when it comes to the applicability of the SAVE plan, of the previous plan as well. Friday's ruling, almost certainly, again, as a part of the Justice Department's work, as a part of the work of the United States Department of Education, almost certainly to be appealed to the United States Supreme Court. We will see this again very likely in the coming term of the Supreme Court, as it takes up this and other issues. And the court may also be urged by the United States Department of Justice even to take it up more quickly. We talked before about this transgender issue, which again, coming up for review. The court may similarly be asked by the Department of Justice on an emergency docket basis to review this more expeditiously and perhaps to issue a decision either on an interim basis or sort of a part of its emergency docket, even in these waning months of the summer term before the new term gets in place. The Eighth Circuit just this past week, determining that the SAVE plan of the Department of Education, the Biden administration plan, cannot stand. Too far, too much, too broad, vast assertion of new power, therefore cannot go ahead as the administration anticipated it going ahead. The Eighth Circuit also active in another area just this past week, and that's right, in the area of book bans. We've got a lot of focus on that in recent days, weeks, and months. Book bans also before the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. Again, this group coming out of all sorts of states, a major swath of geography just to the west of us, including Iowa. A law in Iowa previously passed that bars public schools from having books that depict sexual acts can in fact take effect. That law that bars those books that depict sexual acts, that can in fact now take effect following a ruling by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals just this past week. This ruling basically overturned a previous ruling, an injunction that was issued this past December by a federal district court judge. Now the case goes back to the district court, and that will be for more proceedings under all of this. The law there in Iowa, it's a state law known as Senate File 496, was signed by their governor there, Kim Reynolds, in May of 2023. And it bans any titles that describe sexual acts from K through 12 schools, with the exception of religious texts. The law also limits instruction about sexual orientation and gender identity before the seventh grade, which has led some schools to remove books that address those issues as well. All of that as a part of, again, this Senate bill or Senate file 496 in place since May of 2023, the subject of district court review and now appellate review that says that law can in fact go into effect. After the law was passed, thousands of books there in the state of Iowa, public schools, were in fact banned from those schools. And those included classics and popular fiction like The Color Purple by Alice Walker, Looking for Alaska by John Green, and yes, The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood. All of those things fell under this Iowa law, now upheld by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. Many groups filed challenges to this on free speech grounds. Those included a number of groups, including publisher like Penguin and Random House. Authors joined that as well. In December, the lower court judge, his name is Stephen Lochner, ruled that the law could not take effect. He had temporarily blocked it. He said it was too vague. He argued in his decision, he said it could result in the mass removal of books, casting a puritanical pall of orthodoxy over school libraries. That's what the judge ruled back in December of this past year. The state of Iowa then appealed from that injunction, that ruling of the lower court, state court judge, Stephen Lochner. In the ruling just this past week, the three-judge panel, U.S. Court of Appeals, Eighth Circuit, argued that the injunction had been based on a flawed analysis of the law. The appellate court ruled that removing books from schools does not necessarily constitute a free speech violation when the government's purpose, here in the state's purpose in passing this legislation, is, according to the Court of Appeals, to impose viewpoint-neutral, content-based, age-appropriate restriction on the content of public school libraries. That's all a part of the opinion coming out of the Court of Appeals. In a statement, not surprisingly, Governor Reynolds praised the judge's opinion. She says it should be parents who decide when and if these kinds of explicit books are appropriate for their children. Very significant, of course, as the issue of book bans continues to animate much action around the country. Other places like Idaho and Utah and North Carolina, Tennessee, also seeing book bans among other states throughout the nation. The Eighth Circuit just this past week finding that these kinds of book bans, at least legislated by a state, are in fact constitutional, can indeed go ahead. And for that reason, Senate Law 496 goes into effect and the public schools can in fact take those books off the shelves in libraries there in Iowa. As we continue more coming out of another appellate court here on Amicus, a law review.
This is the Shaw, WAUK.
Cap Time's Idea Fest is back for a week of powerhouse speakers and sessions exploring important local and national topics. September 15th through the 21st in Madison. This year's guest speakers include Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi, former member of Congress Liz Cheney, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, and historian Heather Cox Richardson, along with many others. Idea Fest brings together changemakers to discuss Wisconsin's triumphs and failures to help reach a better state. Purchase your tickets today at CapTimesIdeaFest.com to join this premier thought festival.
An unsuspecting driver at a Milwaukee barbershop.
I got an apprentice here shadowing me. I'll put this hot towel on, man. About a good 3 minutes, all right?
The apprentice is Donald Driver.
So when you come here, you drive?
Yes.
Your car got seatbelts?
Yeah.
You wear them?
No.
Okay, but why not?
I don't want to.
But do you know you can get a ticket for that?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give you a ticket. Bet you wish you buckle up now.
Oh, my God.
Donald Driver can't always be there to remind you.
Take it, click it. There you go.
Click it or take it.
And let's reduce fatalities on Wisconsin roadways. Sponsored by Wisconsin DOT.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for the Devil's Advocates radio show.
This is Amicus, a law review. Thank you for joining me in this weekend weekly broadcast about all things justice-related, court-related, litigation-related, prosecution-related, defense-related, all kinds of things on our docket today and in our final segment here on this weekend broadcast. We're going to talk about another appellate court, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. As I said before, the Fourth Circuit is Maryland, Virginia, West Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina. That's the group of states that collectively comprise the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. And again, any decisions coming out of the federal district courts in those states, where do they go? They go to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond, which is where the appellate court sits. What did the Fourth Circuit do just this past week? Well, the Fourth Circuit upheld a Maryland legislative ban on semi-automatic rifles. Federal appeals court there in the Fourth Circuit just this past week rejecting an effort by gun control opponents to throw out Maryland's ban on semi-automatic weapons and rifles like the AR-15, again, probably setting up another challenge as this almost certainly goes up to the Supreme Court. Question whether or not they'll take on yet another guns case. We know that there were two gun cases just this past term, one involving bump stocks, now made legal by virtue of the decision of the Supreme Court. Another one finding that someone who's got a domestic violence restraining order against them cannot carry a weapon. Kind of a split decision, if you will, on guns this term. Here's another one coming up out of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals finding that the decision by the Maryland legislature to ban semi-automatic rifles like the AR-15 can, in fact, stand. By a margin of 10-5, the U.S. Court of Appeals in Richmond ruled that the ban did not, in fact, violate the Second Amendment right to bear arms, nor did it run afoul of this standard set forth in this case we've talked a lot about called Bruin, that requires that any restrictions on firearms, any conditions on the sale and manufacture, the transfer, the maintenance of it, the use of it, be rooted somehow in historical tradition. You got to look back into history to figure out whether or not there's a basis in history to justify a present restriction, a present condition. That's the 2022 ruling in Bruin that comes out of the state of New York. The Court of Appeals, the Fourth Circuit, invoking Bruin, saying no problem here. Not a problem here. This ban does not violate the Second Amendment, the language, the terms, the conditions of the Second Amendment, nor does it run afoul of this Bruin requirement that you look back in history to determine whether or not there's a present restriction on it. The decade-old assault weapons ban falls outside the Second Amendment protections because rapid-fire long guns are military-style weapons designed for sustained combat operations that are ill-suited and disproportionate to the need for self-defense. That's what Judge Harvey Wilkinson III wrote as a part of this decision coming out of the Court of Appeals. The court declined, as the court said, to wield the Constitution to declare that military-style armaments, which have become a primary instrument of mass killing and terrorist attacks in these United States, are beyond the reach of our nation's democratic processes. Basically saying, can legislatures do this? Yes, absolutely. Under the Second Amendment, no prohibition on restricting, limiting, and prohibiting these kinds of mass killing devices from being a part of our national culture. That's what the Court of Appeals said this past week. Judge Wilkinson says this in an exhaustive, another one of these huge opinions, 183-page ruling, articulating again in great detail exactly the reason why, under the Second Amendment, under Bruin, no problem here with the legislature prohibiting the sale, the distribution, the presence, the use of AR-15s and semi-automatic rifles in the state of Maryland and presumably other places. Undeniably, this opinion is going to have some impact upon other courts out there who look to the same kind of issue. There are dissenters, five judges in the minority. They were they accused the majority here of ignoring Bruin, of saying, no, you're not following what the Supreme Court has said we've got to do. You're not following other precedents in this case. One of those dissenters said, rather than considering the amendment's plain text, once again, invocations of prior justices, including Antonin Scalia, who went back and said that the plain text somehow of the Second Amendment establishes a personal right to gun ownership under Bruin extended to outside the home, and also articulating this position that you've got to have an historical basis upon which to justify restrictions on guns. The minority here is saying that rather than considering the amendment's plain text, the majority in its decision sidesteps its altogether and concocts a threshold inquiry divorced from the right's historic scope. That was written by Judge Julius Richardson. To make matters worse, he went on to say, it then construes the nature of the banned weapons to demean the lawful functions and exaggerate their unlawful uses. Plainly, he's not happy with what the majority has done in this case. Finally, he says, to top it all off, the majority cherry-picks various regulations from the historical record and pigeonholes them into its preferred yet implausible readings of our nation's historic traditions of firearms regulation. Again, all of that about this Bruin notion. Bruin, of course, much the target of dissent and disagreement, as we know from those recent gun cases, by at least three members, probably four members of a Supreme Court, who are suggesting strongly this notion that we justify present prohibitions on guns based upon what our forebears did, what people hundreds, decades of years ago did, all of that suggesting more and more that standard has to be discarded. This particular Maryland law was indeed passed in 2013 in response to what? In response to, yes, that's right, the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut the previous year. Legislature returned and said, you know what? We can't have this kind of thing happening in our schools. It banned many semi-automatic weapons and rifles and imposed a 10-round limit on gun magazine laws. The semi-automatic ban is not the only Maryland law, of course, facing a serious legal challenge. We know in some other courts that federal district court overturned a 2023 state law that restricted licensed gun owners from carrying their weapons into bars and restaurants without the proprietor's permission. That same court, however, did allow the provisions to go into effect, thankfully, for schools and hospitals and mass transit facilities, other places, museums, and other public buildings out there. Significance, of course, in this major case involving the Maryland law is that bans on semi-automatic rifles by a majority of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals can, in fact, go forward legislatively, can, in fact, be imposed here in the state of Maryland under the Constitution, under Bruin, no prohibition at all. More of that and more of our discussion generally of courts, the appellate courts, the district courts, the Supreme Court, as our broadcasts here on these broadcast stations of Civic Media continue every weekend. Join us for those future discussions, and have a good week, everybody.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
Hey, it's producer Conrad. Pete will be back from vacation Monday with guests Rob Thomas and Bill Leff. The Democratic National Convention is next week, so join the Nightlight stream from 7 to 9 p.m. on Facebook, YouTube, or X.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
The Democratic National Convention is in Chicago, and our team will be there to tell you what you need to know.
I'm Civic Media News Director Terry Bell.
And I'm Todd Allball, host of The Todd Allball Show. Count on us for important analysis, interviews, and the Democrats' nomination of their presidential candidate.
Live from the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Listen for updates, plus special coverage at 6 each night. Find it on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.